Chapter 2. How is the Ku Klux Klan like a group of real estate agents? As institutions go, the Ku Klux Klan has had a markedly up-and-down history. It was founded in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War by six former Confederate soldiers in Pulaski, Tennessee. The six young men, four of whom were budding lawyers, saw themselves as merely a circle of like-minded friends, thus the name they chose, Ku Klux, a slight mangling of kuklos, the Greek word for circle. They added clan because they were all of Scotch-Irish descent. In the beginning, their activities were said to be harmless midnight pranks, riding horses through the countryside while draped in white sheets and pillowcase hoods. But the Klan soon evolved into a multi-state terrorist organization designed to frighten and kill emancipated slaves. Among its regional leaders were five former Confederate generals. Its staunchest supporters were the plantation owners, for whom Reconstruction posed an economic and political nightmare. In 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant spelled out for the House of Representatives the true aims of the Ku Klux Klan. By force and terror, to prevent all political action not in accord with the views of the members, to deprive colored citizens of the right to bear arms and of the right of a free ballot, to suppress the schools in which colored children were taught, and to reduce the colored people to a condition closely allied to that of slavery. The early Klan did its work through pamphleteering, lynching, shooting, burning, castrating, pistol whipping, and 1,000 forms of intimidation. They targeted former slaves and any whites who supported the blacks' rights to acquire land, vote, or gain an education. Within barely a decade, however, the Klan had been extinguished, largely by legal and military interventions out of Washington, D.C. But if the Klan itself was defeated, its aims had largely been achieved through the establishment of Jim Crow laws. Congress, which during Reconstruction had been quick to enact measures of legal, social, and economic freedom for blacks, just as quickly began to roll them back. The federal government agreed to withdraw its occupation troops from the South, allowing the restoration of white rule. In Plessy v. Ferguson, the U.S. Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to full-scale racial segregation. The Ku Klux Klan lay largely dormant until 1915, when D.W. Griffith's film The Birth of a Nation, originally titled The Klansman, helped spark its rebirth. Griffith presented the Klan as crusaders for white civilization itself and as one of the noblest forces in American history. The film quoted a line from A History of the American People, written by a renowned historian. At last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, a veritable empire of the South, to protect the Southern country. The book's author was U.S. President Woodrow Wilson, one-time scholar and president of Princeton University. By the 1920s, a revived Klan claimed 8 million members, including President Warren G. Harding, who reportedly took his Klan oath in the green room of the White House. This time around, the Klan was not confined to the South, but ranged throughout the country. This time, it concerned itself not only with blacks, but also with Catholics, Jews, communists, unionists, immigrants, agitators, and other disruptors of the status quo. In 1933, with Hitler ascendant in Germany, Will Rogers was the first to draw a line between the new Klan and the new threat in Europe. "Papers all state Hitler is trying to copy Mussolini," Rogers wrote. "Looks to me like it's the Ku Klux that he is copying." The onset of World War II and a number of internal scandals once again laid the Klan low. Public sentiment turned against the Klan as the unity of a country at war trumped its message of separatism. But within a few years, there were already signs of a massive revival. As wartime anxiety gave way to post-war uncertainty, Klan membership flourished. Barely 2 days after VJ Day, the Klan in Atlanta burned a 300-foot cross on the face of Stone Mountain, site of a storied rock carving of Robert E. Lee. The extravagant cross-burning, one Klansman later said, was intended, quote, "just to let the niggers know the war is over and that the Klan is back on the market." Atlanta had by now become Klan headquarters. The Klan held great sway with key Georgia politicians, and its Georgia chapters included many policemen and sheriff's deputies. Yes, the Klan was a secret society, reveling in passwords and cloak-and-dagger ploys, but its real power lay in the very public fear that it fostered, exemplified by the open secret that the Ku Klux Klan and the law enforcement establishment were brothers in arms. Atlanta, the imperial city of the KKK's invisible empire, in Klan jargon, was also home to Stetson Kennedy, a 30-year-old man with the bloodlines of a Klansman, but a temperament that ran opposite. He came from a prominent Southern family whose ancestors included two signers of the Declaration of Independence, an officer in the Confederate Army, and John B. Stetson, founder of the famed hat company and the man for whom Stetson University was named. Stetson Kennedy grew up in a 14-room house in Jacksonville, Florida, the youngest of five children. His uncle Brady was a Klansman, but Stetson got his first real exposure to the Klan when the family's maid, Flo, who had pretty much raised Stetson, was tied to a tree, beaten, and raped by a gang of Klansmen. Her offense? Talking back to a white trolley driver who had shortchanged her. Because Kennedy couldn't fight in World War II, he had had a bad back since childhood, he felt compelled to defend his country at home. Its worst enemy, he believed, was bigotry. Kennedy became a self-described dissident at large, writing dozens of anti-bigotry articles and books. He became close friends with Woody Guthrie, Richard Wright, and a host of other progressives. Jean-Paul Sartre published his work in France. Writing did not come easily to Kennedy, or happily. He was at root a country boy who would have rather been off fishing the swamps. But he was afflicted by a foolhardy devotion to his cause. Kennedy would go on to become the only Gentile member of the Anti-Defamation League's post-war effort to smite bigotry. He coined the phrase frown power, a centerpiece of the ADL's peer pressure campaign, which encouraged people to pointedly frown when they heard bigoted speech. He became the only white correspondent for the Pittsburgh Courier, the country's largest black newspaper. He wrote a column about the race struggle in the South under the pseudonym Daddy Menchen, a black folk hero who, as myth told it, could outrun the blast of a sheriff's shotgun. What drove Kennedy was a hatred of small-mindedness, ignorance, obstructionism, and intimidation, which, in his view, were displayed by no organization more proudly than by the Ku Klux Klan. Kennedy saw the Klan as the terrorist arm of the white establishment itself. This struck him as an intractable problem for a variety of reasons. The Klan was in cahoots with political, business, and law enforcement leaders. The public was frightened and felt powerless to act against the Klan. And the few anti-hate groups that existed at the time had little leverage or even information about the Klan. As Kennedy later wrote, he was particularly chagrined by one key fact about the Klan. "Almost all of the things written on the subject were editorials, not exposés," he wrote. "The writers were against the Klan, all right, but they had precious few inside facts about it." So Kennedy decided, as any foolhardy, fearless, slightly daft anti-bigot would, to go undercover and join the Ku Klux Klan. In Atlanta, he started hanging around a pool hall whose habitués, as he later wrote, had the cruel, frustrated look of the Klan about them. A man named Slim, a taxi driver, sat beside him at the bar one afternoon. "What this country needs is a good Kluxin," Slim said. "That's the only way to keep the niggers, kikes, Catholic dagos, and reds in their place." Kennedy introduced himself as John S. Perkins, the alias he had adopted for his mission. He told Slim truthfully that his uncle Brady Perkins back in Florida had once been a great titan with the Klan. "But they're dead now, aren't they?" he asked Slim. That prompted Slim to whip out a Klan calling card. It said, "Here yesterday, today, forever. The Ku Klux Klan is riding. God give us men." Slim told Perkins that he was in luck, for there was a membership drive underway. The $10 initiation fee, the Klan's sales pitch was, "Do you hate niggers? Do you hate Jews? Do you have $10? Had been reduced to $8. Then there was another $10 in annual dues and $15 for a hooded robe. Kennedy balked at the various fees, pretending to play hard to get, but he agreed to join. Not long after, he took the Klan oath in a nighttime mass initiation atop Stone Mountain. Kennedy began attending weekly Klan meetings, hurrying home afterward to write notes in a cryptic shorthand he invented. He learned the identities of the Klan's local and regional leaders, and he deciphered the Klan's hierarchy, rituals, and language. It was Klan custom to affix a KL to the front of many words. Thus would two Klansmen hold a conversation in the local clavern. Many of the customs struck Kennedy as almost laughably childish. The secret Klan handshake, for instance, was a left-handed, limp-wristed fish wiggle. When a traveling Klansman wanted to locate brethren in a strange town, he would ask for a Mr. Iack, Iack being code for "Are you a Klansman?" He would hope to hear, "Yes, and I also know a Mr. Akai, Akai being code for "A Klansman am I." Before long, Kennedy was invited to join the Clavaliers, the Klan's secret police and flog squad. For this privilege, his wrist was slit with a jackknife so that he could take a blood oath. "Klansman, do you solemnly swear by God and the devil never to betray secrets entrusted to you as a Clavalier of the Klan?" "I swear," Kennedy responded. "Do you swear to provide yourself with a good gun and plenty of ammunition so as to be ready when the nigger starts trouble to give him plenty?" "I do." "Do you further swear to do all in your power to increase the white birth rate?" "I do." Kennedy was promptly instructed to pay $10 for his initiation into the Clavaliers, as well as $1 a month to cover Clavalier expenses. He also had to buy a second hooded robe to be dyed black. As a Clavalier, Kennedy worried that he would someday be expected to inflict violence. But he soon discovered a central fact of life in the Klan and of terrorism in general. Most of the threatened violence never goes beyond the threat stage. Consider lynching, the Klan's hallmark sign of violence. Here, compiled by the Tuskegee Institute, are the decade-by-decade statistics on the lynching of blacks in the United States. In the 1890s, 1,111. 1900 to 1909, 791. The 1910s, 569. 1920s, 281. The 1930s, 119. 1940s, 31. 1950s, 6. The 1960s, 3. Bear in mind that these figures do not represent only lynchings attributed to the Ku Klux Klan, but the total number of reported lynchings. The statistics reveal at least three noteworthy facts. The first is the obvious decrease in lynchings over time. The second is the absence of a correlation between lynchings and Klan membership. There were actually more lynchings of blacks between 1900 and 1909, when the Klan was dormant, than during the 1920s, when the Klan had millions of members, which suggests that the Ku Klux Klan carried out far fewer lynchings than is generally thought. Third, relative to the size of the black population, lynchings were exceedingly rare. To be sure, one lynching is one too many, but by the turn of the century, lynchings were hardly the everyday occurrence that they are often remembered as. Compare the 281 victims of lynchings in the 1920s to the number of black infants who died as a result of malnutrition, pneumonia, diarrhea, and the like. As of 1920, about 13 out of every 100 black children died in infancy, or roughly 20,000 children each year, compared to 28 people who were lynched in a year. As late as 1940, about 10,000 black infants each died in a year, or 7.5 out of 100. What larger truths do these lynching figures suggest? What does it mean that lynchings were relatively rare and that they fell precipitously over time, even in the face of a boom in Klan membership? The most compelling explanation is that all those early lynchings worked. White racists, whether or not they belonged to the Ku Klux Klan, had through their actions and their rhetoric developed a strong incentive scheme that was terribly clear and terribly frightening. If a black person violated the accepted code of behavior, whether by talking back to a trolley driver or daring to try to vote, he knew he might well be punished, perhaps by death.